The Oral History Committee of Sabre. It's March 19th. I'm visiting with Jim Boughton in his office in Teaneck, New Jersey. Jim's major league career from 1962 to 1978, mostly with the New York Yankees, also the Seattle Pilots, Houston Astros, and and Atlanta Braves. We'll go from here. Jim, perhaps.
Is this on?
Yeah, it's on.
Let's go.
I guess we ought to start the This Is Your Life type of thing by thinking of Newark, New Jersey, March 1939. What was the Boughton family like then? The Oral History Committee of Sabre. It's March 19th. I'm visiting with Jim Boughton in his office in Teaneck, New Jersey. Jim's major league career from 1962 to 1978, mostly with the New York Yankees, also the Seattle Pilots, Houston Astros, and Atlanta Braves. We'll go from here. Jim, perhaps.
Is this on?
Yeah, it's on.
Let's go.
I guess we ought to start the This Is Your Life type of thing by thinking of Newark, New Jersey, March 1939. What was the Boughton family like then? I mean, can you describe it?
My family?
Yeah.
Well, I was the firstborn.
Uh-huh.
And I remember my parents were disappointed. They wanted a girl.
Uh-huh.
They already had a name picked out, Suzanne Louise. And they were very disappointed when a boy was born. They said, they didn't even have a name. I said, okay, we'll just pick out a good basic name, nothing fancy. Jim. Then, a year and a half later, they wanted their girl, and my brother Bob was born. I said, all right, we'll call him Bob. Then about 4 years after that, I think, well, try one more time for a girl. And they missed again. They called this one Pete. So just Jim, Bob, and Pete. They had all these beautiful girls' names, like Suzanne Louise. And
did they ever get to use them?
Alexandra. No, they never got to use them. No.
Well, I'm sure that they were happy with what they got, though.
I'm not so sure about that. I remember one time when we were growing up, my brothers and I were, I think we turned the living room into a small football field. And
I've done that with my brother.
She said, my mother said, I hope you have three kids just like yourselves. Which is a pretty cruel thing for somebody to say.
I think parents have a tendency to say something like that.
Yeah.
Certainly, many times.
Yeah.
So how long did the family live in Newark?
We didn't really...
what was the progression?
We lived at the time, I think, with my grandmother, mm-hmm. who lived in Nutley.
Uh-huh, which is right.
And so Newark was the nearest hospital. I was born in St. Barnabas Hospital.
Uh-huh.
Which I believe is now a shrine. I don't know, I'm just kidding. And so I was just, you know, I wasn't living in Newark, but it was a nearby hospital.
Uh-huh.
And then we moved shortly thereafter. I spent some time in New York City when I was a baby,
mm-hmm.
in Detroit, and Illinois. Mm-hmm. And then I grew up in Rochelle Park, New Jersey. So I spent most of my childhood.
Yeah, that's where you really got your schooling, basic schooling.
Yeah, I went to Midland School.
Uh-huh.
Rochelle Park is a very small town. It's about one square mile.
Uh-huh.
It's located on a small triangle of space between the Garden State Parkway, Route 17, and Route 80.
Uh-huh.
You can see Rochelle Park if you're on a highway and you look down at the right moment, you can see it.
Is this off Route 80?
Off of Route 80, yeah. Rochelle Park was a great town to grow up in because it was a very small town, too small for a little league. There weren't enough kids in town to make a league. You could hardly make two teams. Matter of fact, most of our ball games were, you know, 5 against 5 or 8 against 8, 6 against 4 and 5, 6 against 5 with a steady pitcher or a steady catcher or something like that.
Yeah.
Whoever showed up, we would just make up our own team, make up our own games.
Uh-huh.
And it was better that way, I think, than having organized leagues, because we learned how to make our own fun, make our own games. We'd play one a cat, or we'd play, you know, stickball, all sorts of games. We were always out there playing games, making up games. We didn't have uniforms. We didn't have umpires. We didn't keep...
Same here.
We didn't have leagues. We don't know what the standings were. Nobody got trophies. We just played for the fun of it. And that was great because there were new teams every day. And none of this stuff, you know, we're number one or we beat you guys. And, you know, well, of course, we did that right after the game. But the following day, it was all forgotten. New teams, you know.
Yeah. That's good. But, you know, everybody, not everybody, but most of the people I've talked to have put on these recordings, they usually have a particular school teacher or coach who, in their very young years, was very important to them. I don't know if that's true in your case, but I mean, did you have any particular individual, male or female, that you know, had some impact on you as you were growing up?
I would say my mom and dad,
yeah.
Mostly. Yeah, my dad was a good athlete when he was in high school. He was on the swimming team at Maine High School in Chicago, and he played softball in town, fast pitch softball, which is a very good brand of softball.
Oh, yeah.
And he and I would spend a lot of time playing catch. We always had time to play catch out in the yard and out in the street in front of our house. So I was always playing catch. And then I would go down to the softball games and watch my dad play. And before the games, he'd let me on the field and I'd shag flies during batting practice. And so I was always throwing the ball. And my mom was influential too. She was always there to, you know, sew numbers on her sweatshirt so we could have football shirts, you know. We had our own little football team when we were kids in the neighborhood, and, you know, white sweatshirts, and our moms all put a green number, sort of green number on the back of our shirts, you know. And then my mom and dad were very active in town. It was really...
Now this is Rochelle Park.
This is Rochelle Park. They organized a day camp, the Rochelle Park Day Camp, Ropadeka is what we called it. And we had our own little baseball team, and pitched on the baseball team. And so they were very influential in my early years.
Yeah.
My dad was being willing to play catch with me a lot. But they never drove me to practice or try to make the big leagues. But they just, you know, they just encouraged my own interest and enthusiasm. They didn't think we never even thought about professional leagues or anything like that, the big leagues. It was out of the question. It was not even... It was beyond dreaming. We didn't know anybody. I never knew anybody that was famous. I never knew anybody. We even played professional baseball. I was a little kid anyway. My dad thought I would never ever be big enough to really be a good player, even in high school, maybe. You know. So in grade school, even though I was a good little player, as a matter of fact, I was such a good player when I was a little kid. I had a very good arm, very strong arm. When I was in the fifth grade, I made the eighth grade baseball, the eighth grade team. Now, that's quite a difference.
Yes, it is. A difference in physical development, for one thing.
I was so small that I couldn't, there were no uniforms that fit me. And I had to take my own uniform from home. I had a white uniform, which was okay, except that the team, the Midland school uniforms were gray. So I always had a different color uniform than all the other kids on the team. And a member of my baseball coach there was Mr. Camerano, and he liked my enthusiasm. I was the only fifth grader on the team. There were no sixth graders on the team, and there were only a couple of seventh graders. So you get some idea.
You must have had something going for you.
Of what he thought of me as a fifth grader to let me play for the eighth grade team.
Mr. Camerano.
Mr. Camerano. And I remember one game, he brought me into the game. Bobby Helmer was pitching a no-hitter. And we were beating his team by a big score, and Mr. Camerano evidently was not impressed with no-hitters. So he brought me into the game to pitch the last inning, and I got him out. They didn't score off of me, but they did get a hit, which ruined Bobby Helmer's no-hitter. And on the 30th anniversary of the founding of the town of Rochelle Park, I went back to Rochelle Park and was in their parade, And I don't know if I was the Grand Marshal or not, but I was on the float.
Yeah.
And I went to visited some of the shops along the way, and I stopped into Mr. Eugene's barber shop. And Eugene Helmer told me that his brother Bobby still hadn't forgot that I ruined his no-hitter after 30 years.
That can happen.
He had my picture on the wall of me in a Yankee uniform, and he tells everybody, this is the guy that ruined my no-hitter in the eighth grade. I had a no-hitter in the eighth
grade. I don't think anybody forgets something like that.
No.
That would stand out for sure. But,
so I don't know where Mr. Camerano is, but it was his fault for bringing me into that game. Although it was great. I loved
I can appreciate
getting the chance to pitch in a game. And
now how about high school, though? Junior high, did you play ball there?
Yeah, I played we moved from Rochelle Park to Ridgewood when I was 13 years old.
You're lucky. Beautiful town.
Yeah, beautiful town. And I went to Ridgewood Junior High School. I went to Benjamin Franklin Junior High School in Ridgewood for 2 years. I went my seventh and eighth grade years. And we didn't have there was no junior high school team, but there was a league in town called Big Fry, mm-hmm. which was a league for kids 13, 14, and 15 who graduated from Little League. I had never played Little League ball in Rochelle Park. 13 years old Ridgewood was the first organized league that I played for. I played for Cobb's Sporting Goods Store, mm-hmm. a wonderful old guy with a hunchback. Charlie Poncop was the sponsor of our team. Went down to the field on the first day of practice on a cold April day. And kids were lining up on their teams, and I was new in town. I didn't know anybody. They didn't know me. I was just this little kid. So I was sort of on some line that formed that nobody really wanted to be on. It was, you know, strange kids looking at each other, you know, some other kids from out of town, some kids nobody wanted. All the good kids who knew each other were already they were already forming up the best teams, you know. So we ended up with this team of strange kids and kids that nobody knew or wanted. And we were also the only line that did not have a manager attached to it. All the other teams had managers, guys who were going to manage. So I went home and I said, Dad, we got about 15 guys or 12 guys or whatever for this team, and we got a sponsor, Cobb Sporting Goods, but we don't have a manager. So Dad volunteered to manage the team. He came down there. He was our manager, and he was a pretty good manager, except I remember one time the umpire didn't show up, and they asked Dad to call balls and strikes. And it happened to be that I was pitching that night, so my own father was umpiring my game.
You wouldn't have got the best of that one.
And my dad was brutal. He refused to call the ball a strike unless it was right down the middle, because he didn't want to show me any favoritism. And so as a result, it was the toughest game I ever pitched in my life. It was hard to argue with the umpire.
Well, what about high school now? Did you get on a high school team? Or?
Well, I was a big star in Ridgewood.
Mm-hmm.
It was a small, relatively small town. I was a good baseball player. I pitched a couple of no-hitters in the Big Fry League. And the Cobb Sporting Good team went on, and we won some championships there. We had
That was the team nobody wanted. Turned out
to be pretty good. We had some pretty good little players there. And I think I was the best pitcher in the league. And I also played football. We had our own little football team. The junior high didn't have a football team, but we got up our own team,
mm-hmm.
and we went and we played other towns around. We played the it was the team in St. Luke's junior high school or junior high school or high St. Luke's high school. We played the freshman team, and we had a nice little football team. I was the quarterback on the football team.
Uh-huh.
And
you couldn't have been too little then, Jim.
I played some basketball. No, I was pretty little. I was pretty little, but I was just a very good athlete. I had a very strong arm, so I could throw a pass a long way. And I could throw a baseball. And I could throw a knuckleball. Actually, when I was 13 years old, I had a pretty good knuckleball.
This was long before you were doing it for money.
Oh, yeah, And the knuckleball was a good pitch for a skinny little kid because it was an equalizer. I didn't have to throw the ball that hard, you know. And I learned how to throw a knuckleball. off the back of a cereal package. There's a picture of Dutch Leonard on the back of a picture of Dutch Leonard.
We saw him pitch many times.
And he explained how you throw the knuckleball. You throw with your fingertips and not your knuckles. And the idea is to throw a ball that doesn't spin. So I took that advice and I went out in the yard with my brother Bob and I started throwing them these pitches, you know, with my fingertips, the knuckleball like Dutch Leonard threw, and tried to get it to go through the air without any spin. And every time I threw the ball, it would spin. It was very hard. It's hard to throw a ball without any spin. I must have thrown 500 pitches and they were all spinning. And then one pitch I accidentally threw correctly. It left my hand with no spin and sailed through the air. And my brother, you know, reached up to catch it. And the ball suddenly broke down and hit him in the kneecap. And he went right down on the ground and he was writhing in pain. And he was saying, "What a great pitch! What a great pitch!" So I spent the rest of the summer trying to maim my brother Bob.
But Dutch Leonard, I saw pitch many times because I grew up in Brooklyn. His younger years he pitched out there at Ebbets Field, and he also had a remarkable career. He wound up with the Washington Senators and had a very long career, very much like Wilhelm, but not quite as many years.
Yeah.
And he's a Midwesterner from Auburn, Illinois, I believe, but he had quite a record. And I watched a guy who pitched a knuckleball by the name of Top Presnell. I don't think you would have known him. Anyway, he was an Ohioan, but he pitched, he just held the, gripped the ball with his fingertips. That's how he threw his particular knuckle.
Yeah.
And he threw a fast knuckle. It was interesting to observe that because he was totally different than Leonard.
Right, yeah.
But anyway, it's just your story, not mine.
So just as I was about to leave Benjamin Franklin Junior High School and go to the high school and play for the varsity, and incidentally all the coaches were looking forward to me being a big star in Ridgewood, and this kid Boughton was coming up. I was probably going to be the starting quarterback as a, you know, on the varsity team as a sophomore. I was probably going to be the best pitcher on the baseball team as a sophomore. I don't know about that. I would have made the team in basketball, but I wouldn't have been, you know, the best player. But then my dad got transferred to the Midwest, and we moved from Ridgewood, New Jersey to Homewood, Illinois, which is a small town, a relatively small town on the south side of Chicago. And instead of going to Ridgewood High School with 500, you know, nice white kids, I went to Bloom Township High School with 3,800 kids, blacks, Polish kids, Italian kids, you know.
Now, which year?
All different kids.
What year of high school was this?
This was 1955. Mm-hmm. 1955, I was a sophomore in high school. And suddenly, I'm not going to school with a bunch of white boys, I'm going to school with men. These guys were shaving, for crying out loud. It was like,
what was your dad's
career? It was a whole different world.
What,
you know,
was your dad's career?
I think it's called the real world.
What was your dad's career that brought, you know, resulted in having to move out there?
He was a sales manager for Magnesium Company of America. And so I went out for the football team, and my dad drove me out to the high school and introduced me to the football coach, the varsity football coach. Told him that I was a, you know, quarterback, and I was a pretty good quarterback for my size. And the varsity coach said, "Well, appreciate you coming out, and I'll introduce you to the freshman sophomore football coach." So I went to the freshman sophomore football coach, and I ended up being third string quarterback on the freshman sophomore football team. And I sat on the bench the whole year. I got into one game for three plays.
But you didn't say play me or trade me, did you?
No, I didn't. So it was pretty discouraging. I did not become a big football star at Bloom High School. Went out for the basketball team and I got cut. I was really discouraged. Went out for the baseball team, freshman, sophomore, baseball team, though, not varsity. I wasn't good enough to make the varsity. And I sat on the bench on the freshman, sophomore baseball team. I warmed up. All I did was warm up. I never got into the games. And I warmed up so much that my nickname in high school was Warm Up Boughton. There was a piece of tape over my locker that said warm up. All I ever did was warm up. And I could understand the coach, Coach Jacobite, Fred Jacobite, a very nice man. But he had to go with the kids that he knew from the year before. You know, I was coming into high school, from junior high school in Ridgewood. It was a four-year high school.
Sure.
So when I came there as a sophomore,
sure,
these kids had all been together as freshmen. So he knew them all from,
yeah,
the freshman sophomore team, and he knew these guys, and he didn't know who I was. As far as they were concerned, I was just some skinny little kid from New Jersey, and so I didn't really get a chance to pitch much. And then I didn't play ball that summer for the first time in my life. I was so discouraged. I worked at the A&P in Homewood as a stock boy, stamping 2 for $39 on the Contadina tomato paste. And it was a disastrous year for me, really. I was very discouraged. I had pimples on my face, braces on my teeth, and
in the ensuing years in high school in that area, did you get to play ball finally after all these warm-ups?
Yeah, my junior year, I went out for the team again, and I got to play some more.
Mm-hmm.
Although I was still the number three or four pitcher on the team in my junior year. But that summer of my junior year, I went out for the American Legion team,
yeah,
in Chicago Heights. And it was a great experience. The first day of practice, it had rained, and I went to the field early to see if I could, I was going to practice with the team, and nobody was there yet because it had rained, and I was out on the field, and I was raking the field to get it in shape to play.
Uh-huh.
While I'm out there raking the field, I hear this voice from the sidelines.
Yeah. Hey, what you doing?
I turned around, and there's this guy with a black crew cut standing on the sidelines. His arms were folded. Looked about 35, 40 years old. He said, I'm raking the field to try and get in shape. He said, what position do you play? I said, I'm a pitcher. He said, he had this Godfather kind of voice in an abrupt way of speaking.
Very hoarse.
Yeah.
He said, what position you play?
I said, pitcher.
He said, you're too small to pitch. You'll be second base.
I said, no, I'm a pitcher. I'm a pitcher. I really am. I'm a pitcher. I'm not a second baseman. You'll see. He said, okay, we'll see. So I practiced with this team, and a couple of weeks later, they had the opening day of the season and the opening game, and he announces that I'm the starting pitcher in the opening game of the season. Now, the Legion team is basically the same guys as the high school team.
Yeah, they usually is.
Same thing, just a different,
yeah,
coach. And when he names me the starting pitcher, the other pitchers are saying, hey, Earl. The guy's name was Earl Detella. Earl Detella. Said, Earl, he Bouton is like, he's number four pitcher in the high school. He's warm-up Bouton. He's not very good, really. What are you doing pitching him for? I mean, Earl said,
the first day of practice, it rained. You guys didn't come. He showed up. He raked the field. He wants to play ball. He's the pitcher.
So because I raked the field, and he saw that I loved the game, he gave me a chance to pitch. Well, I won that game. And when my turn came up in the rotation again, he pitched me again. And he pitched me all summer long. By the time the summer ended, I was the ace pitcher of this Legion team. We got into the tournament. We won our conference championships.
How far did you go in the tournament, the national tournament?
We went, we lost in the, first is regional, then district?
Regional, I think, I'm
sectional.
Not sure which came first, district or regional, but it doesn't matter. Did you get through one or two of those?
Yeah, we won a couple of rounds. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that was a great program, that Legion program.
Yes, it was wonderful.
American Legion. Many major leaguers go on playing American Legion.
Yeah. American Legion Post 131, Chicago Heights. And we got to the sectionals,
yeah,
and we lost to the team that eventually went on to win the whole thing.
Well, and that's no disgrace.
No disgrace at all. Anyway, at the end of that summer, the local sports writer, Johnny Myers, wrote a column, which was an open letter to the varsity baseball coach, telling,
yeah,
Coach Jacobite about the Legion team and what a good team it was. And he some new players were discovered.
Yeah.
And one of them was Jim Bouton. So when I went out to the varsity my senior year. Coach Jacob, I moved me right into the be number one pitcher, which shows you what a good man he was.
Sure.
He was willing to see what happened that summer, and he saw that I emerged as a as the top pitcher, and he moved me in. So I was the number one pitcher in my high school.
You have great recalls. You have great recalls, you know, this is great.
My senior year. And,
We did
pretty well. We had a great team. We won our conference championships. The first game of the state tournament, I pitched against a kid named Miles Zeller, who pitched for Rich High School. He was, at that time, considered to be the best pitcher in the state of Illinois. Miles Zeller went on to play at the University of Arizona, and I think he signed a professional contract and played with the Cubs minor league system mm-hmm. for a couple of years. Anyway, Miles and I hooked up in the first game of the state tournament. I threw a no-hitter. We won 7-0. We went on. We finally got knocked out down in the state finals by a team from Maywood, Proviso High School, and they beat us 3-2 in 13 innings. I lost that game, but that was the tough game. But it was a great capper to my high school career.
I would certainly think so, considering when you started, you had all you could do to scrap your way into the rotation.
Yeah.
When did you first attract the kind of notice that, sparked the Yankee interest?
Well, after that, my high school season, I was still pretty, skinny and small, mm-hmm. and I really only had a good senior year there, so scouts weren't really talking to me. They weren't that interested. They were looking for bigger, stronger guys.
Sure.
I went to Western Michigan, mm-hmm. which had a very good baseball program.
Mm-hmm.
They always went to the national championships in Omaha, Nebraska every year. I couldn't get a scholarship to Western Michigan, so I was a walk-on there mm-hmm. on the freshman baseball team. Coach was Fred Stevens, a wonderful guy. He didn't care if he had a scholarship or not. Yeah. Gave everybody an equal chance. And I emerged on that team with two other kids, Bill Ortlieb and Bob Hammond, three of us. Did most of the pitching. We were the top three pitchers mm-hmm. on the team. I guess we were about equal. They both had scholarships. One of them was from Indiana, one from Ohio. I was from Illinois. There were three out-of-state kids pitching for Western Michigan in Kalamazoo, Michigan. So I had a pretty good freshman year. The year after my high school, before I went to Western Michigan, I played for this team in Chicago in the summertime called Cook Sportscraft. Mm-hmm. They were known as the Chicago Yankees because they won the Chicago Park District Championships every year. I was trying to play on the best team I could play for.
And was that kind of a semi-pro team?
It was like a semi-pro team, exactly. And they played in the Chicago Park District. Mm-hmm. We played out of Portage Park on the north side of Chicago. I lived on the south side, so I would drive my car up to Portage Park. The great thing about Cook Sportscraft was that they played a lot of games that were in addition to the Chicago Park District schedule. So we would play neighboring towns. We'd go up to Kenosha, Wisconsin and play the Kenosha Chiefs. We went down to Peoria and played against the Caterpillar team. We played against all these semi-pro teams in the area. But the best games we played were against the prisons. We played at Joliet State Penitentiary. Uh-huh. And those were great games to go play against the prisoners.
Was there some real talent there?
Pretty good players. Well, they had lots of time to practice.
Lots
of time. And even if it was raining all day long, like it would be raining on Saturday, we'd have a game in the prison on Sunday. Manager would say, it doesn't matter if it's raining, come to the game, show up. We would all drive down in our cars because they always have the field in shape no matter what, because they've got like 3,000 groundskeepers were there. And they'd bring us through these different, you'd go through these lockup sections, they'd lock you up, you'd move through another section, they'd lock you out, then you'd finally get to the inner sanctum. We'd get out on the field, and lots of fans showed up for these games. Long lines of guys wearing blue denim would file into the stadium. Thousands of fans filling the stands. Beautiful ball field in the prison.
I imagine nobody slid into second with their spikes high.
We were concerned about that. We would say, don't slide in too high at second base. I think that guy choked his grandmother to death or something like this. Watch out for the guy on third. He's a killer. He's in for. Be careful. But it was a wonderful experience. The prisoners would bet on the games. They would bet not only on the score of the game, the outcome. They would bet on what the next pitch would be, whether it would be a ball or a strike. And they would bet cigarettes. And after each pitch, you'd see cigarettes going back and forth. As a matter of fact, when I would be warming up before the game, on the sidelines, the prisoners would all be in there, you know, watching the warm-ups and the practice, and I'd pop a good fastball into the glove, and you could see cigarettes changing back and forth as the odds would change. Hey, this kid can throw the ball pretty good. That would change the odds, you see. And so, and the prisoners would always root against the prison team. Well, they would start rooting for the prison team a little bit, but as soon as the prison team fell behind or made any mistakes, they'd turn on them immediately. And I think basically they were jealous of the prison team because they got to get outside, they got
some privileges,
practice,
yeah.
There was some privileges, there was some, there was some status. They probably fed them. Maybe they got extra showers, I don't know. I got a terrible cold, I don't
everybody
like
has it this time of the year.
So it was fun to play in the prisons. It was always a road game when we played the prisoners.
And tell me, in college, did you get some attention from the scouts? Or
no, not really. So after that summer with Cook Sportscraft, that's when I went to Western Michigan and played on the freshman team. Yeah. Still, nobody was really talking to me because I didn't really. I don't think I looked that good. I wasn't an imposing figure. Mm-hmm. I wasn't what they were looking for. They were looking for big, strong guys who could throw the ball hard. But after my freshman year in college, I went back and I played for Cooks again.
Mm-hmm.
And this time, we got into the national tournament. We won the Chicago Park District mm-hmm. Championship. We went to Battle Creek, Michigan. And we're in Battle Creek, and I won my first game against West Virginia. I think it was 4-1, something mm-hmm. like that. Pitched a pretty good game. It's a double elimination tournament. And we were 4-1 or 5-1 going into our big game against Cincinnati. Cincinnati had a very good team. They were the graduates of the famous Bentley American Legion post teams that they had down there in mm-hmm. Cincinnati. Cincinnati had a very good team. They were winning all their games with scores like 18-0 and 22-1. 16-3, and so we were supposed to get knocked out of the tournament on a Sunday afternoon. We had one loss already, and we were playing Cincinnati, and it was my turn to pitch. I was the number three pitcher on the Cook Sportscraft team, so everybody figured we were going to lose this game. Well, they pitched the best game of my life. On a Sunday afternoon, I shut them out. Two-hit shutout. We beat Cincinnati 2-0. Their first loss of the season. The first time they didn't score less than 10 or 15 runs. They scored no runs. Well, after the game is over, well, all the stands were filled with scouts because they all wanted to see the Cincinnati kids.
Yeah.
All these big hitters who were going to be signing these contracts as soon as this game was over, as soon as this tournament was over. And now, they were swarming on the field. The scouts were coming out. They wanted to know, who's this kid that beat this Cincinnati team? So I got scouts coming over to me. What's your name? Where are you from? How old are you? You know, we don't have anything in our files on you. Where'd you come from? I had to give them the whole history of who I was. And they took all the information down. They said, we'll talk. We want you to come work out with the Phillies and the Tigers, and St. Louis was interested in the Yankees, and a whole bunch of people really wanted them. They were talking contracts and bonuses and stuff. And I drove home from the tournament. And
you must have been on cloud nine.
Oh, I was. I burst in the door, and my dad was sitting around the table, the dining room table, playing bridge with some friends, I said, hey, Dad, I just pitched a great game in the tournament. I shut out this team from Cincinnati, and these scouts are wanting to know how much money I want to sign a contract.
Too bad he didn't see the game.
Scouts are really talking big money, Dad. They're interested. And he said, oh, that's nice. To no Trump. I said, no, I'm serious, Dad. These scouts are really, they're going to be calling on the phone any minute. What should I say? He said, tell them you want $50,000, three spades. And he doesn't quite believe me, and he's playing the card game, he's playing this bridge with his friends. And 2 seconds later, the phone rings. I pick it up, the scout from the Philadelphia Phillies. I said, my dad says, I need $50,000 to sign. In those days, I think still do. I wasn't 18 years old. I was only 18 years old. I needed my parents' permission.
Yeah.
scout said, well, 50,000 sounds reasonable. We'd like you to come down, however, and work out one more time with the Phillies. So I hung up the phone and I said, the scout is from the Philadelphia Phillies. He said he thought 50,000 would be possible. He wants me to take the train down to Philadelphia and work out with the Phillies. My dad said, the card game is over. Suddenly there was...
Oh, that's great. That's a great story.
Yeah. Suddenly there were more chips on the table here.
Who was the guy that with the Phillies... Oh, he didn't eventually sign you, did he?
No, I think it was Tony Lucadello. Was it?
Oh, yeah.
Was Tony Lucadello, wasn't he with the Phillies?
I think so. The name's familiar, though.
Yeah. So I went down to Philadelphia, and it rained. I stayed at the Warwick Hotel. I remember leather padded elevators. It was great. I ordered about a $15 dinner with two appetizers, and I thought I was really, you know, going to make a bad impression on the Phillies that I ate so much food. Went out to the stadium and it rained, and I never worked out with the Philadelphia Phillies. But I did get to. It took me to the clubhouse and I met some of the players, and they were sitting around. Pudd'nhead Jones and Richie Ashburn and Dell.
Yeah, those were the Whiz Kids.
The Whiz Kids were there, and they were. I walked into this clubhouse. I've never been in a major league clubhouse before. These guys are sitting around in their underwear, jock straps and stuff, drinking beer, playing cards, smoking cigars. But this is the baseball team? It seemed like a bunch of old guys sitting around. It just didn't seem like any baseball team I've ever been on, you know? So anyway, the Detroit Tigers called. They wanted me to go to Detroit, so I flew out to the Tiger Stadium, and I worked out with the Tigers before the game, and I pitched to a catcher on the sidelines. And then the general manager, or the farm director, Catalina, Ed Catalinas?
Yeah.
I think Ed Catalinas was the farm director. He said, all we're willing to go is, we'll give you $10,000. You got to put some meat on those bones, he said. You're a little too skinny. We'll give you $10,000. I said, no, my dad says I need... My dad had told me that if I got a $30,000 bonus, he'd let me leave college and sign a professional contract. But if I didn't get $30,000, he wanted me to finish college first. So I said, well, $10,000 wasn't enough. Philly's never called back. St. Louis Cardinals never called back.
You worked out for those teams.
No, I never did.
Oh, you never did?
No, the only two teams I went to work out with were Detroit and Philadelphia, and it rained in Philadelphia. So I really only threw on the sidelines to one team,
right.
Detroit. But I'm not a sideline pitcher. I just didn't look good on the sidelines.
Sure.
I need to be in a game. So summer was over. I'm back at school at Western Michigan. A couple of months go by, and nothing's going to happen. I'm not going to get a bonus. Teams have all lost interest. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm very disappointed. This wonderful game I pitched, they all figured it's probably a fluke. They went back and they looked in their files and they realized they didn't have anything on me. And maybe it was a lucky game, you know. And then my dad sprung into action. He had a great idea. He wrote a form letter. Dear blank, my son Jim is prepared to sign a professional contract. If you're interested, please have your bid submitted no later than November 1st. And he mailed it to the Cardinals and the Phillies and the Tigers and the Yankees and all the teams that had expressed an interest in me. As if I was some big hotshot bonus baby and there was going to be some like bidding contest for me and they better have their bid in by a certain...
Well, it was the sales manager in action.
He was the sales manager in action, exactly. Well, the Yankees bid. They said, we're interested. And we'll send Jerry Coleman out to the house to negotiate.
Let me interrupt you for just a moment. But you had not worked out for the Yankees.
Never worked out for the Yankees.
And no scout had approached you at that point?
The Yankee scouts had been talking to me. But coincidentally, here's what happened. The manager of that team, Cook Sportscraft, was a guy by the name of Art Stewart. Right after that tournament game, I didn't realize it, but he was signed as a Yankee scout. So he knew me.
Oh,
I see. He had been my manager for 2 years.
Right.
He told them that
understood
that I was a good pitcher
because
he had seen me under pressure and seen me in tight situations, and he knew me, so he recommended me. But he was a new scout for them, so I don't know how much credibility a brand new scout had.
Yeah.
but he recommended me, and Jerry Coleman came out to the house to talk to us about a contract. This was in November, just before Thanksgiving. And in order to make an impression on Jerry Coleman, my dad took some letters from the Cardinals and the Tigers and the Phillies that we had gotten with the team logos on them, and he spread them out conspicuously so that Jerry Coleman could see that there were many, many teams bidding for my services. In fact, nobody was interested in me. And Jerry Coleman, we had a nice chat, and then he reached into his pocket and he pulled out a contract, and the terms of it totaled $30,000. Because I had said I needed to have $30,000. The way it was structured is, I think $10,000 was going to be a bonus. There were 3 years of minor league, 3 years of guaranteed salary, $5,000 a year. Mm-hmm. That would be $15,000, plus the 10 is 25, and five if I ever made it to a major league team.
Right.
And my dad says, well, Jim, this is really just a $10,000 bonus. $15,000 of it is salary for 3 years, and the other five is if you make the big league someday. So really, it's $10,000. I said, but Dad, it all adds up to 30. You said 30. This is 30.
You were doing some selling there.
Yeah, my mom said, you know, well, we don't want you to leave college because then you'll be, you know, you could become a baseball bum. These guys that spend all their life trying to make the big leagues, they never make the big leagues, they don't get a college degree, and then they're out on the street, and they have no skills, and they have no education, and what are they going to do?
Sure.
I said, I really wouldn't. They knew how badly I wanted to try, so they signed the contract for me. They let me sign. And after Jerry Coleman left the house, we thought it was great that my dad had pulled a fast one on the New York Yankees. And then 3 years later, when I actually made the Yankees, I started to tell my dad that a really astute father would have gotten me $100,000.
Particularly after those years of 63 and 64.
Right. Right.
Let me, a couple of questions that I had there. Which minor league teams did the Yankees send you?
The Yankees had 13, I think, minor league farm teams. And they had a vast minor league system.
I'm familiar with Norfolk, Columbus.
Well, I'll tell you the farm system. They had two AAA teams, Denver and Richmond. They had two double-A teams, New Orleans and Amarillo.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's four.
West Texas, yeah.
They had an A team in Binghamton. They had a B team in Greensboro. They had three C teams, Modesto, California, Fargo, North Dakota, and someplace else. Mm-hmm. They had four D teams, St. Petersburg, Florida, Auburn, New York, Kearney, Nebraska, and some other godforsaken place. So they had, now think of how many teams that is. That's 13 minor league farm teams. I went to spring training in Columbia, South Carolina, which is where the minor league teams had their training base. There were hundreds of guys running around with numbers on their back like 109.
You know, like a track meet.
146. A whole bunch of teams were having their spring training at the same time. I felt totally lost. And I calculated that if I was a new, had just signed, I was at the bottom of this pile of guys. 13 minor league farm teams, 10 pitchers a team. That's 130 guys that are ahead of me. It's 130 pitchers between me and the big league. And every one of these kids is a good player. They were all stars. They're all the best players from the towns they came from. The best pitcher, the best hitter, the best second baseman. Best player from Appleton, the best player from Oshkosh.
It's like trying out for the Chicago Bulls, but you know, in a basketball sense.
Yeah, I mean, geez, it was incredible. They were all big, strong guys. So my first spring training, they assigned me to Class D, Auburn, New York. I go up to Auburn, New York, and I pitched a couple of games. I'm doing pretty good. And then I pitch in a game against Erie, Pennsylvania, the New York, Pennsylvania League. It's a Detroit Tiger farm team. A kid named Pernell Goldie is up to bat. Pernell Goldie hits a line drive at me right in the thumb, breaks the thumb on my pitching. The next day they flew me to New York to see Dr. Gaynor. He wrapped it up, put it in a, not a cast, because they didn't want to have the muscle deteriorate. Yeah. So they just put a wrap on it.
Yeah.
Said don't bump it into anything for a couple of weeks. And they sent me to Kearney, Nebraska, which is the rookie league, which is down below D. So I'm sitting in the bleachers in Kearney, Nebraska, waiting for my thumb to get better. And that's when I did the calculation. There's 130 guys ahead of me. I wrote a letter to my dad in Kearney, Nebraska, and I said, there's only two guys on this team that have a chance to make it. There's three guys on this team that have a chance to make it to the big league. Boyd Coffey, a catcher, Bob Lasko, a pitcher, and myself. And that was the height of arrogance, to have a broken thumb in the bleachers, predicting
that you'd make it to the
big leagues. And
what did you take in college, Jim? What was your major?
Well, I was going to be majoring in business.
Yeah.
But my first year in college, I took history of American civilization, mm-hmm. Western civilization, communication, and then painting and Spanish. My guidance counselor said it would take me forever to get a business degree with those courses. But I just wanted to take courses I wanted to take.
I can understand.
I
was just curious.
I liked Spanish in high school. I really liked my Spanish teacher. Harriet Murray was her name. She was. I was not a good student in high school. I would get A's and B's in courses that I liked, like Spanish or art. Or geometry, and then I would get a D where I failed the courses I didn't like algebra, you know, science, and other courses. So
did you stay at Western Michigan long enough to get your degree?
No, I signed after my freshman year. I signed a contract, and I went for the fall semester, and then in the spring I would leave to go play ball. And after my summer of baseball, I'd go back to college again for the fall semester, and I did that until I made the big leagues.
Right.
So I did that for 3 years. I ended up as a second semester junior by the time I left college. And I never did finish my degree because my winters were too valuable. I needed to earn, I was
sure
too many opportunities to earn money, and a degree wouldn't have helped me anyway. At that point, I was doing a lot of speaking and just in college.
It is, huh?
Okay.
We got it. Good, it's not here.
Okay. After that year in Kearney, Nebraska, I spent the rest of the summer in Kearney, and I got to pitch a little bit at the end of the season when my thumb started to feel better.
Yeah.
Following spring, I went to spring training and with Greensboro. That was a Class B team. Now, usually you go to spring training with a team that's higher than you're going to actually end up.
Mm-hmm.
What they do is you spring train with the B team, and then when the major league team cuts down, and then the AAA guys cut down, and then everybody cuts down, so if you start with B, you're going to end up back in D or C. I figured I was in D ball the year before. Maybe they'll move me to C, hopefully. So I'm in spring training with a B team, and I start the season with Greensboro. And just before cutdown day, Dooley Womack, who's scheduled to start that night, can't get loose. His arm is bothering him, so they give me his start.
Yeah.
And I pitch that night, and I win the game. Well, I think only won a few games by that point, and I had won one of them. So they couldn't cut me. I had just won a game. 4 days later, Dooley's start came up again. He wasn't ready to pitch, so they pitched me again, and I won. Well, after the first 2 weeks, I had 4 wins. I was 4-0, and when they did their final cut, they couldn't cut a pitcher who was 4-0, so they let me stay there. I ended up making the All-Star team for Greensboro. I made the All-Star team in the Carolina League, Class B. So I never played C ball. And then that was a wonderful summer. I loved playing ball down in Greensboro, and I learned how to eat grits and black-eyed peas. I stayed in a rooming house. Mrs. Sykes had a house in the neighborhood with her attic. She rented out to the ball players, so about 8 of us stayed up there. No air conditioning, just a fan. About 8 beds crammed into 3 rooms, sharing a refrigerator. But it was great because it was only about a dollar a night or something like that. for each one of us. I think we paid $10 a week or something. And on a salary, when you're making $500 a month, you know, you can't spend too much on your accommodations.
What's that?
So I stayed up there with Jack Cullen, Dominic Maisano, and a couple of other guys. And then there were guys coming and joining the team, so we would have a roommate for a while, then we'd lose him, then we'd get another roommate, we'd lose him.
How do those boarding houses work? Do people let the ball club know that they're interested in that space?
Yeah. Yeah, they would come down to the ball club and say, you know, they'd put stuff on the bulletin board, have an apartment for rent, or I have room for three ball players. And, you know, you're sort of a celebrity in the minor league. Even though you're a minor league ball player, in that town, you're a big shot. You get your name in the paper.
I want to tell you, I went to an Eastern League championship game between the Scranton Red Sox and the Utica Blue Sox. The Utica Blue Sox were the team that you reported to, the Philadelphia Whiz Kids at that time. They were playing a Scranton team that had Willard Nixon and Jimmy Pearsall on it, and George Strickland and a few others. And the excitement at that game, this was a, you know, you'd think it was a World Series.
Yeah.
The local people were there.
Sure. Yeah, so you'd walk down the street, and, you know, the girls would, you know, come around, and people wanted you to stay at their houses, and, you know, it was great. It was life. It was nice to be a professional ball player. You'd sleep late in the morning, get up, have a big breakfast, go down, shoot pool for a couple of hours, and wander out to the ballpark, take batting practice, you know, sign some autographs, play a ball game, go out for steaks after the game.
When you were growing up in this area, did you have any particular feeling about the local ball clubs as to which was your favorite team, or did you have any?
Oh, I was a Giants fan all the way. Even though I signed a Yankee contract, I was always, I had rooted for the New York Giants before they moved to San Francisco. My brother and I would go to the Polo Grounds and watch the Giants play. We were fans of Dave Coslow and Larry Jansen and Eddie Stanky and Alvin Dark and Monty Irvin, Whitey Lockman, Henry Thompson. I can give you the whole lineup.
That was a great year. So,
Plus,
DeRocher was the manager there in that great 51 year.
1951. As a matter of fact, in 1951, I came home from school to watch the end of the playoff game on television. And just as I walked in the door, my mom was ironing in the living room. And I flipped on the game, and Thompson hit his shot into the left field bleachers. And the Giants won the pennant. And I ran out of the house. My mother said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to Robert Iriana's house." Robert Iriana was a Dodger fan. And we were always riding each other. Dodger, who was better, the Dodgers or the Giants? The Dodgers or the Giants? Who was better, Duke Snyder or Willie Mays? Constant arguments, Dodgers and Giants. And I couldn't wait to get to Iriana's house.
In Brooklyn, we used to call that particular game Dat Day.
Dat Day, right. So I ran all the way to Iriana's house. He lived on the other side of Rochelle Park, so it took me about 10 minutes to get there, but I had enough energy to run the whole way. And I got to Iriana's house, and I rang the doorbell, and his mother came to the door, and she says, "Robert's not feeling well. He's not coming out." And I looked up, and all the shades were drawn, and Robert Iriana didn't come out of his house for a week. He didn't come to school the next day. He did not come to school. That's how heartbreaking that was for a lot of kids.
Yeah, there's a
he was marked for life. He may talk with a stutter today for this. He may walk with a limp. I don't know.
There's an addendum to that story. Bobby Thompson's mother was listening to the game on the radio in Staten Island, or watching it on television, and she got so tensed up she turned it off.
Oh.
And she never heard him hit the home run until a neighbor ran across the lawn yelling, "Bobby did it, Bobby did it." You know, and it's just quite a dramatic day.
Yeah.
But anyway, you were a Giant fan. And
so I was a Giant fan. Of course, once I signed with the Yankees, I started following the Yankees, and I became a Yankee fan. And after my season in Greensboro, I made the All-Star team there. The next year, they started me off at Double-A. And Amarillo, Texas, and I made the All-Star team there. Had a good season, so I skipped A. So I never played C or A.
Well, this is your third year.
This is my third year in the Yankee system, and I played. I made the All-Star team in Amarillo. Following spring, I was invited to spring training with the Yankees as a non-roster player. had an Amarillo contract, but I was probably going to end up playing in Richmond or Newark. No, or I think they had gotten rid of Newark by that time. I think it was Richmond. Mm-hmm. So I figured I would play in Richmond.
Yeah.
But I had a great spring. I got into an extra inning game against the Cardinals at St. Petersburg, and I did very well. And so they gave me another shot, and I did pretty well. And by the time spring training was over, I had given up something like 4 runs in 25 or 30 innings or something like that. I had one of the best springs. And about 3 days before they were ready to break camp, Ralph Houck came over to me and whispered in my ear, he says, you made the ball club, but don't tell anybody. The reason he did that is he just wanted to watch my reaction, how I could keep this a secret without telling anybody, you know. So I knew I had made the team.
I imagine your folks reacted very...
They'd
been sort of a long trail with you.
Yeah, well, it was... Yeah, they had come down to Greensboro and watched me pitch there. And,
that's great.
But, you know, who knew whether I could stay in the big leagues or not.
Well,
I signed my Yankee contract on opening day at Yankee Stadium about half an hour before the game. Roy Hamey comes down. He said, here's this contract, kid, sign it. I didn't even have a chance to read it. But it didn't matter anyway. He says, you're getting $7,000 like everybody else gets in their first year, so sign it.
But let me ask you this. You, in your books, of course, you devote considerable time to to your major league managers, but how about your minor league managers? You got any thoughts about them, the one that you had in Kearney, the one that you had in
Yeah, let's see. My first manager up in Auburn, New York was Bobby Bauer.
Mm-hmm.
I like Bobby Bauer. I was always a hard-working kid. You know, I would run in the outfield and do my wind sprints, and I was always in great shape. And so any manager that respected that or liked that, they always liked
sure.
me because I was
you came to play.
Yeah, I came to play exactly. I came to play, and so I always got along very well with my managers. My manager out in Kearney, Nebraska, was Jimmy Gleason.
Oh, I remember.
Real old
Jimmy G.G. Gleason.
Mm-hmm.
Played for the Newark Bears.
He was a real old-timer, but what a great guy he was.
I remember, I saw him play for the Cubs.
He was a wonderful guy, Jimmy Gleason. And then in Greensboro, I played for Hal Charnofsky, who was a college guy from... I think he played in the Yankee minor league system. He was an infielder. He got released. They signed him. They made him a manager.
Mm-hmm.
He won a pennant in his first year, and then he retired because he had some... I think he wanted to get married and, you know, go back to school or something like that.
So, you know, if I were a Bobby Bauer or a Jimmy Gleason, I would have been very proud that guy, one of my guys made the big team, and particularly after your World Series victories and things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's... You know, the money is great, but there's also a lot of satisfaction in
sure.
knowing somebody made it and
yeah.
made it the right way.
Yeah.
The
manager I remember most, I guess, is my double A manager, Sheriff Robinson.
Uh-huh.
He was a real character.
Wasn't he a nephew of Clark Griffith?
I'm not sure,
yeah.
but he was a really interesting guy, and I liked Sheriff a lot.
Yeah.
And he liked my curveball. He liked my curveball. He said, I like that snapper, kid. You got a good snapper there.
Was your curve your out pitch or your fastball?
Either one.
Yeah.
And equally good.
You could control your curveball.
Curve, yeah, I could throw my curveball.
I
for
know
strikes.
You don't make it to the majors unless you can put that where you want it.
A couple of nights he came over to me. I had a real good curveball. I'd strike out about 10, 15 guys. I was striking out 10 guys a game easily in the minor leagues. And he came over to me one night. He says, you could have got him out up in the big leagues with that one tonight, kid. He really gave me some confidence.
That's great.
He also showed me how to get my body into the ball a little bit. I wasn't turning my foot sideways on the mound. My foot was still pointing toward home plate when I would release the ball. He got me to lay it in there right along the rubber so that my whole body could turn a little bit more. He also got me to pitch off the right side of the rubber so that it was coming across the plate. It'll be a little more intimidating.
How about...
Sheriff Robinson was a funny guy. He'd have the same advice. We'd go over the team before the game, and he'd say, we'd say, what about this guy? And he'd say, jam him. Sheriff would say, jam the son of a bitch. Jam him. You can jam him too, boy. You can jam... And that was his advice. You can jam him. You can jam that son of a bitch.
Well, who was the guy?
Jamming was like throw.
Who was the guy, the manager you had that said smoke him inside? Was that Joe Schultz?
That was up in the big leagues at Seattle Pilots. But anyway, Sheriff used to say, jam this guy. You can jam this guy. You know, that means throw a good fastball inside on his fist, you know.
Yeah.
I remember a couple of years later, I was talking to somebody. It was in the big leagues, and I was in the outfield, and we were talking about managers we had. And I said, I played for Sheriff Robinson, and Amarillo said, oh, yeah, we used to. He said, I played ball against Sheriff a long time ago, and Sheriff played ball. He was an outfielder. I said, oh, yeah. I said, what kind of a ball player was he? He said, he was pretty good. He said, but you could jam him. He said, we used to get him out all the time. We used to just jam him.
That's where it came from.
I realized, sure, I figured if he couldn't hit it, nobody could hit it.
Now, when I saw you pitch for the Yankees, you had filled out quite a bit. You were a pretty sturdy,
stocky
guy.
Well, I did that in my first year in the minor leagues. Before I went down to report, I felt I needed to put some weight on because I was skinny. And so I would eat five meals a day. Five meals. I would have a snack in the middle of the afternoon, a big snack, and then I would have another meal just before I went to bed, in addition to breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And I ate so much. I put on 20 pounds. I weighed 25 pounds. I weighed 155. I went to 155 to 180. I was real stocky.
Weight must have helped you then.
Oh, it helped me tremendously. Now I had a very good fastball. But I almost ruined my stomach because I was eating so much. I got something called duodenitis, which is like before a duodenal ulcer.
Yeah.
And so when I went down to spring training, I was on a special diet. I could only eat, you know, cottage cheese and, you know, certain kinds of soft things. I couldn't eat raw vegetables. I couldn't eat this. So when they would have, spring training, out there, and they'd have lunch out there. We'd work out in the morning, have lunch, and then go back out on the field. They had to order special food for me to eat. So I'm like, who's cottage? Oh, Boughton. Boughton's got the cottage cheese. Boughton's got the, who's yogurt? What is the yogurt? Well, that's Boughton. He's got a special diet. So I had a special diet. And also, I had shin splints. I guess I wasn't used to the new weight that I had. So my shins would hurt me tremendously when we would do our sprints in the outfield. And the only thing that made my shins feel better was if I ran in sneakers instead of my spikes.
Spike, yeah.
So I would go in and change into my sneakers. So while everybody was running in spikes, I'd run in sneakers. Well, these guys thought, who in the hell? I mean, look at this kid here. He's, you know, the old timers, the older guys, the older minor league guys. You know, there's this guy, he eats cottage cheese, he eats yogurt, he's running, he's got these sneakers on. I know. I was really calling attention to myself in a way that I didn't need it, you know.
How about...
A good fastball can cancel all that shit out, you know.
I'm sure of it. And the record proves it. How about Ralph Houk? He must have been quite a guy. I know he had a great war record. And,
well, I have mixed... I loved Ralph Houk when he was a manager. When I first came up to the big leagues, I thought he was great. I mean, he just, no Mickey Mouse business, you know. He just let the guys play ball. No curfews, no hollering at players. He wasn't babysitting anybody. Figured we were men, and just leave us alone and let us play ball. No matter how badly we'd get beat, doesn't matter. Hang in there, get them tomorrow. We'll get these guys. We'll get these son of a bitches. And he was always positive, and he just let us go out and play ball, and I just thought he was a great manager. When he became the general manager, however, in 1964, and Yogi was made the manager, then Ralph wasn't so terrific because he forgot what it was like to be a player, and he was then using, his friendship and everything to pound you down and not give you what you wanted. So the tough guy Major, who was a tough guy to umpires and other teams, was now a tough guy to his own to his own guys, and he was very unfair to me on contracts and stuff, and I just didn't think that was very fair of him.
I throw out a few names here. I know you played with Bill Scourer and Bobby Richardson.
Oh yeah, I played with listen, people say to me, gee, don't you wish you were playing today with all these big salaries? And my answer is no. I'm glad I played when I played. I played with the best players, the most interesting guys. Kubek, Richardson, Mantle, Maris, Pepitone, Elston Howard, Yogi Berra, Whitey Ford, Louie Arroyo, all the you know, the great names in baseball. I wouldn't trade that for anything.
There was a few names here who must have been quite colorful. Pepitone, Linz.
Oh yeah, well, Pepitone and Linz, I played in the minor leagues. Linz was the shortstop on that Greensboro team.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, he and I both made the All-Star team. And then the following year, we both made the All-Star team again. He was the shortstop at Amarillo. Well, now we had Pepitone on the team. So Linz and Pepitone and I, we led the Amarillo team to the league championship. And then we were on the Yankees the following spring. We were not, you know, your normal rookies.
Some of the fellows you played with on the Yankees, I always thought, for example, this guy Repose would have turned out to be a better ball player than he did.
Roger Repose, yeah.
He had all the physical equipment.
He did. He was great. He had a wonderful swing, and he had speed and power and a great arm.
That's surprising, you know. And you had Roy White, of course, who was a fine ball player.
Yes. Roy White was a fine player and a wonderful guy.
Do you ever get to talk to Tony Kubek since he's become the announcer now?
No, I haven't. Well, once in a while I've run into him. Yeah. Not recently. Tony didn't like Ball 4.
Oh, yeah.
Tony said Ball 4 was a bunch of lies. Lies, all lies. That was his quote.
They'd say that or say it was the wrong thing to do or something like
that. Yeah.
How about Hector Lopez?
Hector was also a wonderful guy.
Yeah.
Hector saved me, you know, my first spring training, my first start with the Yankees.
Yeah.
In Yankee Stadium, was against the Washington Senators. And I shut them out, 7-0.
That was your first start?
My first start was a shutout. But it was the worst shutout in the history of baseball. I walked 7 guys, and I gave up 7 hits. So I stranded 14 runners in a 9-inning game. And twice, with the bases loaded, Hector Lopez caught these long line drives in the outfield with these great running catches. And he's not known as a defensive outfielder at all.
I remember playing right field.
Hector, what a pair of hands, Lopez.
And he could also handle that bat. He was great at
Oh, he was a
right
very
field.
Good hitter.
Yeah. He could put that ball almost any place he wanted to do it.
He was a very good hitter. He loved Fenway Park.
Yeah.
Oh, he used to go off that wall all the time.
I remember him, you know, very well. Did your dad and mother get to see your opening game at Yankee Stadium?
Oh, yeah. My dad and my mother was there. My brother Bob was there.
Yeah.
And Pete. And Bob was so nervous that at one point he was smoking 2 cigarettes. They noticed.
Well, that's understandable. And they eventually got to see you win a couple of World Series games, too.
Oh, yeah.
Which
yeah.
Has to be a highlight in your career.
Oh, yeah. Those were fun days, really. Magic days.
Of all the ball players on the Yankees that you played with, do you have 2 or 3 that, you know, you'd have to say were, you know, you'd rate above all the others? Of course, Mantle, and his ability and his record and everything else, like I said. I don't know. It's up to you. I'm just curious to get your reaction.
Well, I think the records of the guys speak for themselves in terms of their baseball playing ability. But I always, you know, to me, the guys that were most interesting to me were, you know, who were the most interesting people? What kind of people were they? And
I gathered that from your books.
Yeah, and I thought Phil Lynch was probably the sweetest guy, the nicest guy on the team. He was a really nice fellow. I like Steve Hamilton, too. I liked him very much. He and I had these wonderful long debates in the outfield. We'd debate politics and
Johnny Blanchard?
Guns.
Did you play with Johnny?
Yeah, I played with Johnny Blanchard, yeah.
And Maris, how did you react to Maris?
At first, I liked Roger a lot.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, Roger gave me a glove when he saw I was using an old glove. He said, here's a new glove, and he gave me one of his gloves, which I thought was a very nice thing to do. And I liked Roger. But I saw that he seemed to make life much more difficult for himself than it really needed
to
be.
I would think so.
You know, he didn't seem to be having as much fun at his job. He really did not enjoy most of the things that you would think somebody would enjoy about being in the big leagues.
Yeah, he had a little trouble handling the attention.
He liked playing the game.
Yeah.
And he loved that, and he loved, being in the locker room and hanging around the guys. But the minute he had to do anything else to do with life outside of the ballpark, he didn't really enjoy it. He didn't like fans that much. He hated reporters, and life just seemed so difficult. I thought to myself, Jesus, if you take anybody off the street and let him hit 61 home runs, pressure or not, they'd have a ball with that.
Absolutely.
Gee, this is a time to have fun, my goodness.
Well, not only that, but many ball players would use the media to for their own purposes, too.
Sure.
And certainly he had every opportunity to do that. I guess it has to do with your makeup and the background and everything else.
To me, those extra things are the part that I really loved about baseball. I couldn't wait to sign autographs. I couldn't wait to talk to the reporters. I liked getting my name in the newspapers. To me, that was part of the fun of being in the big leagues. Hey, you got the headlines of the daily news. This was part of the fun of it, to be a celebrity. Roger not liking publicity and being a big league ball player is like being a doctor and not liking blood. You know what I mean?
That's right. It's so right. You had a few characters on that team there. You had Jim Coates.
Coates. He was a character.
He must have been a pistol. He was a real redneck, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, sort of. But he was a decent guy.
Yeah.
There were so many. The great thing about baseball is that it was a very democratic sport. In that it didn't matter, how young or old you were, or how tall or short you were, or what part of the country you came from, or whether you had an education or didn't. And so you had a tremendous cross-section in the locker room. You'd have a guy with a college degree. You'd have a kid who just got out of high school. You had some guy from Panama. You'd have another guy
in the Army or the Navy.
From Brooklyn. You'd have exactly. It was very much like being in the Army or the Navy. You're thrown in with all these guys, and the one common denominator in the Army is that you're in the Army. The one common denominator in baseball is everybody knows how to play ball pretty good.
Yeah.
So Coates was, from Virginia. And he was just like he walked, like he'd been walking up and down hills all his life. that gait. And he was real skinny, and he had these his ribs would stick out, and he would haze the rookies, when the rookies were not behaving themselves, or when Pepitone or Linz or myself would, were not being respectful enough of the institution and of the Yankee clubhouse and the traditions. It was Coates who would point these things out to us. Hey, Rook, get me a beer, or And so then we would try to find ways to taunt Coates. And I think the one I remember the most is in the locker room. I asked him. I said, Jim. I said, are those your ribs, or are you wearing a herringbone suit?
How about Whitey Ford?
Whitey was a good guy.
Yeah.
Everybody liked Whitey. He was the greatest competitor I ever saw. I saw Whitey go out to the mound with a sore arm. He couldn't even lift his arm above his shoulder, hardly, and he'd throw sidearm and get the guys out. It was amazing.
Observing him pitch, I got the impression that his success, of course, had to do with his control and the different speeds at which he could throw his pitches.
Yeah.
He'd have a slow curve and a fast curve.
And movement on the ball.
I didn't think he was that fast, but I guess at certain points...
Quick. He was sneaky quick.
Yeah. But he certainly had the talents.
He was marvelous.
He sort of came up through the system like you did. It seemed to me that he came out of... I think it was Binghamton that he...
Yeah.
He made the hop from Binghamton to the Yankees.
Big league, oh yeah, that's
right. And Stengel was managing the thing. And how about Ralph Terry? He was a pretty good golfer.
Terry was a wonderful guy. Matter of fact, Ralph always had some good advice for me. After I won my 21st game in 1963, came over to me and he said, I'm real glad to see that you got number 21. He says, because 20 looks like you just barely made it.
Oh, that's a great line.
And then another time he said to me, this was before the before my first World Series game against the Dodgers in 1963. I was sitting on the bench and I'm just about to go out and pitch against Drysdale in game three of the World Series. We'd lost game one and two, and I'm a little nervous. And Ralph sits down next to me on the bench. He puts his arm on my shoulder. He says, "You nervous, kid?" I says, "Ralph, I can hardly breathe." I said, "Well, let me tell you something, kid. When you're out there on that mound today, just remember this. No matter what happens, win or lose, 500 million Chinese communists don't give a shit."
That's great.
Yeah.
Love it.
It was wonderful advice.
And there's a couple of guys there that, Fritz Peterson, he's a colorful.
Oh, I liked Fritz. Fritz and I were roommates for a while. And he was a really nice guy.
He's a Midwestern, I think, out in Illinois.
From Illinois, yeah.
And
he was left-handed all the way.
And I'm looking at some of these other names here. Pete Ramos, Jake Gibbs.
Yeah, Pete Ramos and I used to... Pete would bring a BB gun out to the bullpen. And underneath the stands during the ball game, we'd set up a little rifle range with the BB gun. We'd set beer bottles and beer cans and stuff, and then we'd stand back there and shoot the beer cans. And every once in a while, the phone would ring. Hagan would holler in there, "Ray, Ramos, get hot, or Bouton, get loose." We'd say, "No, not yet, Jim. We got two more shots."
Yet you got to play on the Yankees with your pal Dooley Womack.
Dooley Womack,
teammate,
right,
from,
yeah.
I think he was raised in Columbia, South Carolina.
Columbia, South Carolina, yeah.
And Al Downing.
Yeah. Downing was a nice guy.
Mel Stottlemyer.
Yes, I like Mel.
He's really, he's been able to stay in the game. And
yeah, his son Todd is doing terrific.
Yeah, this last year in particular.
Yeah. Mel stayed at our house one time. When he first came up, he couldn't find a place to stay, so he stayed with us for a couple of weeks. And I remember Todd running around the house with diapers on. Last time I saw Todd Stottlemyer, he had diapers on.
Well, that's the way I felt with Dolph Cavilli when I used to see him play in Brooklyn. He'd bring his little kids to the ballpark. Mm-hmm. Three of them wound up playing professional baseball. You know, I couldn't believe that.
Yeah.
Let's get into Seattle here now. There you had Joe Schultz, right?
Yeah.
And you had
Joe Schultz was the opposite of Vince Lombardi. Joe felt sorry for us when we lost. He told us not to feel bad. We just didn't have the talent.
But you had some guys there like Tommy Davis, Jerry McNerney.
Yeah.
Mike Hagan.
Yeah. I like Tommy. Tommy Davis and I were good friends.
Ray Euler. Don Mincher, big fella.
Ray Euler passed away.
Did he? Oh,
yeah.
Was that right?
Yeah.
I wasn't aware.
Mincher from Alabama.
And big guy, wasn't he?
Yeah.
How about Greg Goosen?
Greg Goosen, yeah.
And you had some pitchers there. Of course, you covered some of them in your book. Marty Patton, I know you like very much.
I like Marty. He did a wonderful imitation of Donald Duck having an orgasm.
but
he did it perfectly.
And how about your pal Mike Marshall there? He was a factor of the Seattle team.
Yes, yeah, Mike was the resident weirdo on the team.
I always enjoyed
along with me.